Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your host for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Ben Halderman, who is ably standing in for Mike Stefan from Planet Labs. Ben Halderman works on rockets, launching large numbers of Planet Labs Dove satellites to space. He also works on corporate strategy, has delivered over 100 spacecraft to space, and led the design of Planet Labs' instrument payload to image the Earth daily. Ben completed his master's in mechanical engineering at UC Berkeley, where he designed life detection instrumentation for a Mars rover mission. Ben specializes in bringing a new agile approach to hardware and space. Without further ado, Ben Halderman.
Thank you, Gerald. So this image is the blue marble. As the Apollo 17 astronauts headed to the moon, they looked back and took the first image that covered the entire Earth in one shot. And these astronauts, only 24 have seen the whole Earth like this. And they speak about how this raised their consciousness of how little our home was, how little our home is, and how important the Earth is. And this image is actually one of the most famous images our species has taken and most widely distributed. And it became a symbol of the environmental movement as well. And so this image, it's beautiful, but it's stagnant. And even current satellites and what governments and other commercial agencies have put up there have been slow refresh rate. And our planet is really changing at a very increasing speed. And we've come to realize that you really need much higher revisit rates and much higher coverage to cover our planet. And like one case would be right now we see images of the rainforest, and maybe the last image we had was a year ago. And you can see giant sections of the rainforest disappear. And what if not only could you see that daily and then make action on that, but what if you could have computers actually calculate the numbers of trees we have on the planet or the numbers of trees everywhere and just watch those statistics change in real time? So at Planet, what our mission is to image the entire world every day and then provide universal access to this information. We're doing this by building what we call a line scanner for the planet. So 150 satellites and overlapping images of the Earth. And so they would go around and take images at the same time every day. We're aiming for 10:30 a.m., and to do this, we've had to take a new approach to space. We've leveraged what has been done in Silicon Valley as far as miniaturization of components and electronics. And our satellites actually, they resemble a lot more a cell phone than a traditional satellite. So this is this is the current state of the art as far as Earth imaging, NASA Landsat. And these satellites can cost close to $1 billion and take 10 or 20 years from concept to actually working in space. And this is actual size our Planet Labs satellite. And so we've leveraged this new way of doing space and to make them much smaller, do much higher quantities of them, and then also take an approach where we're able to take higher risk and not be afraid of having some of these fail. So relying more on large numbers than single, super reliable. And our story is not too much different than many Silicon Valley startups. We started in a garage, and we took on an area in an industry where it was loaded in old processes and outdated ways of doing things. And then we took a new way, a new look and a new approach at an industry of how could you disrupt this and do this differently, and approach, throw out the old rules and approach something in a new way. And so this is our actual satellite, a model of it, but true size. And it has everything that the large satellite has. It has solar panels that pop out. It has radios on the front. It has an imaging system, an optical imaging system, and then a camera in the back. And then everything needed to point this and know where it is, and then do the image processing as well. So some of the components inside, we've relied on advances in lithium-ion batteries and advances in small sensors that can fit on the circuit board, such as photodiodes that can tell which way the Earth is, which way the sun is. We have little magnetometers to tell where the Earth's magnetic field is pointing and then point relative to that. We have GPS on these, so we can tell exactly where they are. And then we've also learned how to manufacture these in large quantities and to apply modern manufacturing techniques to satellites. And we actually last year built around 150 of these, which ends up being more than the rest of the world built as far as satellites. So all in San Francisco. Granted, they're very small, though they have a lot of the capabilities that large satellites do. And then here's Alex Wen, started as an intern with us. And he's been the lead on manufacturing every one of these. As far as he's touched everyone, he knows the detail of everyone. And that's pretty amazing. An intern coming out of college, Alex has manufactured more satellites than anyone else on this planet, and all in the last 2 years. And then we also have Forrest Stearns. Forrest joined when we were about 30 people as a full-time art director for our team. And so we put art on the side of the satellites, and I was working on design of the satellites at the time, and Forrest really, he helped inspire me create more elegant and beautiful designs. So really bringing art close to our team and helping that inspire how we approach space. And we also really wanted to make space seem more accessible and more beautiful and more elegant rather than cold and dark and far away. And not only do our satellites take images, they're also pretty photogenic and are being seen in many magazines now. And so the approach we've taken, we call it Agile Aerospace. We started with a very simple design and did as much commercial off-the-shelf technology we could. We used an off-the-shelf camera. We used off-the-shelf computers and many circuit boards. And then we started customizing and adding more and more features as we went and then compacting these down. And actually, we're on our 13th build now. And this build actually has more free volume in it than any of the other ones, even though it's much more densely packed with capabilities. So instead of one long design cycle of trying to figure out, okay, what is everything we need for this and design all that, it's been rapid iteration. And you know, sometimes you make mistakes and then take those out later. And then sometimes you've rushed a feature in that wasn't ready and that gets to space and does not work, though that's been our business model is to rely on building these quickly, testing them in space, not overanalyzing, not be afraid of some of them failing, and just really drive down the time from adding a new feature till it's in space and working. And then so not only do we have to do space, we also have ground stations around the world as well to talk to them. And these are decorated with art as well. This is in New Zealand, and it has a 4-meter dish inside there that points to our satellites and tracks them as they come over. And then when you think of mission, satellite mission control at NASA or another large organization, you think of a big control room like this. And they can have hundreds of people that work on one satellite. And each person is monitoring a different system of it. We simply couldn't do that, and that would not scale as we move towards hundreds of satellites. So this is what our mission control is. Maybe one person on the weekends, maybe nobody. And we've actually, I'll show you in a bit, our satellites being deployed. We actually had two satellites be deployed from the International Space Station at the wrong time. We weren't expecting them. And so they came out automatically without anyone knowing. The astronauts did not even know. And they floated around Earth, and our ground stations picked them up without expecting them and started talking to them, started updating the software on those, and started getting them ready to take imagery. So really trying to automate everything we can to prepare for large numbers and do that differently. And then this is what we currently have in space. We have about 50 satellites. We've launched over 100 now. The ones in this narrower orbit that don't go as high, that is from the International Space Station. And then the ones in the larger orbit are what are called sun synchronous orbit. So they're at a perfect angle, so every picture they come down in the daylight side is at the same local time. So the shadows are all the same, the illumination of the imagery are all the same. And then, so over time, we're moving more towards that orbit because it's more ideal, though we've taken this agile approach where the space station was available and there's a lot of rockets going up to it, so it was the easiest place for us to learn and test our technology without going the more expensive route of going to these dedicated orbits that not many rockets go to. So it's a complicated system. We have all the satellites, 150 of them. We have 30 ground stations. This ends up being 11 terabytes of imagery coming down each day. And then we're building the modern API-driven data platform that all the images go onto the cloud, and we're bringing access to them to everyone. So how do we get these to space? This is a Cygnus cargo module. Our satellites actually get loaded in there with bubble wrap around them, actually, and they get launched on a rocket up to space. The cargo module goes around the Earth for a couple of days as it adjusts its orbit and aligns with the space station, and then it approaches, and the astronauts steer this robotic arm out to grab it, and then it comes in and docks with the space station. The astronauts physically go in there, unload the satellites, and then load them onto a robotic arm. And so we're looking, this is a Russian cosmonaut taking an image out the window of two satellites about to get launched. And so this is special for me because most people who work on satellites, they never get to see them actually floating in space. So this is a pretty rare experience to see satellites that you've built that are meant to image the Earth floating over top of the Earth. And right now they're floating out of control, though we'll wake them up and start controlling them and then start taking images of the Earth. And there's been many challenges along the way. Space still is difficult. The satellites have to, as they go around the Earth, they go around every 90 minutes, which is when they're behind the Earth versus when they're in the sun. It's like going between the coldest place on Earth and the hottest place on Earth. So equivalent of going from top of Everest or Antarctica to Death Valley every 40 minutes. And so that puts a lot of stress on the satellite. And we've launched 12 different times out of 4 different countries on 5 different rockets. And we had 28 satellites on this launch. So that's the most satellites ever lost at once. And this was the Antares launch in October of last year. So an anomaly on the launch, we lost 26 of them. And that would normally be a major loss for a company, for a space company that may kill a company or set it back 5 years. Though for us, we've built a diversified launch manifest that launches out of different countries and frequently launches so that we can handle events like this, because space can be unpredictable and it is still hard. And then one other thing that happened here is this rocket exploded. They actually found 8 of our satellites on the beach next to here, and they had sand on them, though all of them actually still worked once we got them back. And one of them had come out of its deployer, and once they're out, they open up and turn on automatically. And so its radio was trying to contact a ground station already. So satellites that have survived a rocket explosion. And then launches delay also. Our average launch delay so far has been 1 year. So that's the challenge of, this is where the old space, the old way of doing space collides with the new way of doing space. We build technologies that we want in space weeks or months after we build them. And we still have to rely on a very unpredictable and slow way to get to space. So that's been one of the big challenges. And we're launching large numbers of these. So you can see in comparison to the rest of the planet, all the governments, or the rest of the world, all the governments, how many satellites they're launching. Other industry, we're launching a significant number of these. And like I said, all these get built in San Francisco. And then we have a large number planned for next year. I'm not sure how many the rest of the world is, but it could easily eclipse that. And so to help get around our challenge with rockets, we actually bought a complete rocket. And this one, it used to be an ICBM from Russia, and so it used to carry a nuclear warhead on it. And so it's pretty awesome to see that we've converted that to then have a peaceful mission and take our peaceful doves to space and help us better understand our planet. And so the way these rockets work is they get exploded out of the ground, and then they get launched once floating in midair. So we'll have this launch this year. And I actually just got back from Amsterdam meeting with the Russians on the details on this launch. So we want this to be more than just imagery. This becomes a data platform for the planet. And it's not just uses we can think of and uses that people looking at images can think of. It also becomes kind of like a nervous system for the planet as far as humanity and Silicon Valley is adding all sorts of new ways of sensing the planet, from Internet of Things applications or drones or other spacecraft, and then even applications like Twitter give us this sensing and large amounts of data for the planet. And so really that all kind of like weaves together to be this new way we can look at the planet and understand how it's going, how it's changing. And so that's been driven by miniaturization of technologies, and then the ability to handle huge amounts of data, and then the ability to build machine learning and apps that come on top of this and then make it so someone can build a simple app that comes in and quantifies something that would have been impossible without all that data already being organized. And then so some of the images that we're already taking, this is a glacier in northern Canada. I was actually on a glacier last week with my one-year-old daughter in the back, Luna Dove, and it made me really think about like how different glaciers will be when she grows older, and so it's awesome to have a record of that and see how these change day to day. And then other applications such as agriculture, the productivity of agriculture around the world varies drastically, from 10% productivity to some places approaching 100% productivity as far as how you use that land. And so along with productivity is not just the dollars you're getting out of the land, it's also water usage. It's are you putting drops of water exactly where they need to go? Are you overwatering or underwatering? Are you detecting pests as they pop up versus once they've destroyed a large chunk of the field? So from space, you can actually tell these images are 3 days apart, and then we have software that picks out what has changed in those days. So there's helping farmers better use the land and make higher productivity agriculture. And then there's also helping the world and market intelligence better understand crop yields and make better predictions and use food in better ways. Other images of agriculture. In these two images, we see a fire being used to clear crops on a land. But that's not the only change. These are one day apart, and you can see in these fields, and then up in the top, there's significant change just happening in one day. And then also industry and I guess overall how the world's developing. These are in China. Every time we look at pictures of China, there's entirely new towns popping up and new industry, or in some cases new giant solar panel fields, which is awesome to see. So as we quantify these, you can start to get a picture of how materials are moving around the planet, where pollution is coming from, how financially different areas are growing. And then this here is showing a dam being built, and this is over the course of 1 month that river significantly changed shape there, and this will have impacts downstream of the river as far as water quality and amount of water, and also helps people better estimate the amount of power that comes out of that and see overall development. Another awesome use case was the earthquake in Nepal. And after that happened, it was the first time we actually had enough imagery. This image in the back is our imagery. You can see there's some holes there. Though for the most part, we had the most up-to-date imagery of Nepal when the earthquake happened. And so we were able to provide this imagery for free to aid workers. And they actually found two different areas where there was no city on the map. You can see in this image, this is what they saw was just a blank road. Though when we provided our imagery, it showed significant towns in those areas. So aid workers were able to redirect efforts to two new areas that were not being approached. Another beautiful image of a frozen lake. And then where we are, San Francisco. And so we actually chose a resolution of about 3 to 5 meters. We can zoom in a little on this, though you can pick out cars occasionally, though not accurately count cars and definitely not see people. So it's a resolution that helps to serve our mission of understanding the planet, understanding how it's changing, understanding trees and forests and agriculture without having big implications on privacy, and overall give us a chance to see how the world's changing. And then, so our mission has been not only to image the whole Earth, but to use space in a peaceful way to help us better quantify and understand the Earth, and then help us be better stewards of our rapidly changing planet, and then to hope to democratize this information and make it accessible to everyone in a transparent way, and so that helps everyone see the Earth in the same way, and hopefully raise consciousness to how small a planet we actually live on, and how connected it is. So, thank you very much.
Our thanks to Ben Haldeman for bringing us up to date on the revolution in small satellites. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We will now open the floor for questions. Please make your questions short. There's a mic right back there. Either you can line up or I can bring the mic to you.
Hi, Ben. Thanks. Great presentation. Question, I'm just absolutely amazed that you created a startup that is putting satellites in space. Could you walk us through the stages of, you know, getting some smart guys together and realizing that there's a possibility of putting satellites in space? Because that gap is just an amazing thing for me.
Okay. Yes. So I was about the 20th employee. I was not one of the first ones. The three co-founders came out of NASA. They had worked on trying to help NASA become more agile and trying to work on seeing new ways of doing space within NASA. And they made significant progress, and NASA is doing awesome things. Once they had the concept and saw the availability of excess capacity to launch small satellites on larger rockets. So traditionally, you would need to buy a whole rocket, but the market was opening up for this standard, which is called CubeSats. And so that opportunity showed a way of getting to space without having to go through whole rockets. And so they decided to start the project in their garage, had a small team join them, and started growing that. That was about 5 years ago, and then 2 years ago, moved to San Francisco. I joined about 2.5 years ago when we were 20 people. In that part, we did a seed round of funding. We did a Series A round of funding of $8 million, and then some larger rounds of funding after that. So we've done now a Series C is our third main round of funding. And now we're about 150 people. We actually just acquired another company, which is about another 100 people. So we're approaching several hundred people in a couple of years, or in the last couple of years. And I think that's kind of a good summary of how it's scaled.
Hi. So you're doing amazing stuff. Thanks for coming to talk to us. I wanted to find out how you manage the life cycle of learning and development. So you've gone through 13 cycles in Agile, or in your Agile process, but there's a huge lag between when you build something and the product is launched, or the satellite's launched, and then you learn from it to build the improvements back into the life cycle. How do you manage that? Do you have simulations? Do you just like know, oh, oops, we messed up on, you know, a couple of generations back? How do you manage that, and how do you build it going forward?
Yep, good question. So we have built up the testing procedures to get a pretty good idea of whether something's going to work before we fly it in space. So that is one way, though we have always and will continue to rely on space to test things and not wait until there's very low risk before we fly something. So we have two different ways we fly satellites. We have what are called technology demonstrations, and those are one-off satellites where we put new technologies in them. We might be soldering those wires in the week before we ship those. And so we really try to drive down the time between those tests, those technology demonstrations, between when we build them and then when they're in space. And then we have the larger constellations, which we do more of a manufacturing approach to those, and then do higher volumes of those. And so those have a slightly lower risk. Additionally, with the approach we've taken is we're trying to release every quarter. So as initially, it was very dependent on when the rockets would launch, and we would rush to get satellites built before a rocket. And that still impacts us, though we're decoupling the manufacturing from the design. So we're able to do designs and release those every 3 months, and whatever new technologies get in those 3 months, you can think of it as like a bus shipping, a bus leaving on its schedule. If it's not ready in that time frame, then it doesn't make that build, and then it goes on to the next one. So we've tried to decouple the manufacturing from the design cycle also.
So how many satellites can you fit in one cargo container?
Great question. I'm a little stumped. I'm not sure how many would fit in one of those cargo containers. The large rocket that we bought, could hold 192 of them. So there are many different sized rockets out there. There's new smaller rockets that can hold a couple of them or 20 of those. Those are not commercially available yet or ready yet. And then there's really large rockets. Like SpaceX has the Falcon 9, and that I think could hold about 700 of these. So a wide range depending on which rocket and which one. So the question was, what was the mass of the average satellite? And the mass is 4.7 kilograms, which is times 2.2, I don't know, 11, 12 pounds, 14 pounds. And then to answer a previous question about how do they point, there's two different ways. There's little motors inside that act kind of like gyroscopes, so they're referred to as reaction wheels. So you spin those up, and that creates a moment on the satellite. So they can point relative with that. And then the other way we do it, if you only had reaction wheels and your satellite comes out and is spinning, you would have to spin those the opposite way, and they would always have to be spinning at max speed the opposite way to slow them down. So then we also have coils of wire in there. And when you run electricity through a coil of wire, it creates a magnetic field. And so we create a magnetic field relative to the Earth's magnetic field. And then that helps it lock onto the magnetic field and slow down. And then we can slow down the motors, the speed of the motors. So there's two different ways to control it. And then as far as feedback, there's magnetometers that tell us which way the magnetic field is, and then the photodiodes to tell where the Earth is.
So the idea of using kind of small satellites to get information about the Earth is really inspiring, which kind of, given that this is San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, leads me to ask, do you have competition or other people working with small satellites to really kind of capture all of this data and information? Mm-hmm.
There are a growing number of small satellite companies, and there are companies doing slightly larger satellites as well. There are some may be competition. We kind of look at it as complementary. There's not one doing exactly the same approach as us, as far as we see what we're doing as a monitoring mission, where we're taking a picture of everywhere on the Earth every day. We're not taking a picture of just where people pay us to take a picture of. And then so some of our competitors, they operate more in that model. They might have higher resolution imagery and be more zoomed in, though the cost that comes with that and having that larger satellite is they can only point at so many areas each day. So they take what is called a tasking mission. And so someone pays them to take the image, and then they take it. So then you don't have with that model, you don't have the data archive that you have of just recording the Earth. And then you also don't have imagery of areas that were uninteresting to you yesterday. So if an earthquake happens, you don't have yesterday's image because you weren't looking there. Though having higher resolution imagery also helps a lot. So they're complementary in many ways.
I think you said that you use a CubeSat design. So I was wondering what the advantages of being able to use kind of off-the-shelf CubeSat hardware are. And what do you see as the disadvantages, the weaknesses, the gaps in a CubeSat architecture?
Okay, thank you. We've actually not used standard CubeSat hardware that we've bought. We've done all that custom ourselves. To fill in a little more information for everyone else on that, this CubeSat is a standard. Ours is called a 3U because it's three of those long. One would be 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And so there are companies that make standard circuit boards that fit inside those and make it so universities can make satellites themselves. And a large number of universities have satellite programs now, which is awesome. Like, students in university can build something that goes to space. And so we've built our own custom components for many of those. We've used off-the-shelf cameras that are non-specific to CubeSats. Though approaching this with the CubeSats, it has limited our resolution of we're taking the highest resolution we can from that size factor. Though that was ended up being kind of the resolution we settled on as a good compromise between covering large areas and also not having the privacy issues. And then being in that CubeSat form factor has really opened up a lot of launch opportunities to us. The program that goes to the International Space Station was built for this size satellites. So it's been overall a great approach to getting satellites in space.
By nature of what you do, do you fall into certain federal national security supervision? And in that respect, does it cost you time and money? And also relative to that, are you free to cooperate or partner with international organizations or people?
Mm-hmm. The regulatory hurdles have been challenging for us. Overall, we have a great relationship with the U.S. government and with regulatory agencies, and we've helped them see our approach to space and help them adapt to the way that space is now being done, and other companies are now approaching it. So it has been a challenge to deal with companies deal with a system that is used to knowing 5 years away what satellite is going to be launched and having those regulatory approvals happen early. But yes, we have to deal with NOAA, the FCC, and several other organizations as far as regulatory. As far as working with other countries, at our resolution imagery, you're allowed to sell it and provide it anywhere in the world. And so we do have international partners. We've built that to sell our imagery in other countries and help get it out there. Though overall, yes, there's been other international concerns as well.
Thank you for your presentation. Couple of related questions. One, is there any thought process on repurposing of these satellites given, say, for example, a business model change for your company in the future? And two, is there any thought behind the end-of-life process? You know, what happens when either something fails or it's outmoded? Is there any way of, you know, decluttering space, if you will?
Great question. And yes, the cluttering of space is a major issue. Our satellites, they are low to Earth, and they actually, the ones from the International Space Station burn up in 8 months. So they burn up completely in the atmosphere. The ones going to 475 kilometers in sun synchronous orbit, those burn up after about 4 years. So we do control them, though we do look at them as a disposable asset that gets completely burned up. And we're actually able to control them to there's actually some drag in space, so we can actually either make them more aerodynamic or slow them down. And we do get collision warnings. So we'll get an email saying there's a 0.001% chance of a collision in 24 hours from now at this exact second. And you can actually slow down the satellite enough to make that percent chance go away. So there are ways you can mitigate that. And though there's also debris up there that we don't know about that can cause collisions. So our primary fail-safe method has been to launch them low enough so that, worst case, they're still only up there for a couple of years. Then was there another part to that?
Repurposing in case of business model change.
Oh. There's potential there. There's a lot of this satellite and a lot of the design is applicable to other missions you could do from space. We're pretty heads down focused on what our mission is right now for imaging.
Ben, I was wondering if you could describe the software you guys use to help manage all the different engineering information that comes with a lot of different revisions and a lot of different configurations of satellites, and also any type of software you guys use to help manufacture the most satellites in the world.
Mm-hmm. So we've built a lot of that ourselves, and like you mentioned, our manufacturing, probably a third of that team so far has been building software for how do you build satellites reproducibly, how do you make it so someone from the audience here could come into our satellite factory and sit down and just follow instructions and build as good a satellite as Alex Wen could build one. So yes, that's been a big part of automating it as well. Without getting into too many details about software that I don't know too well, we're using cloud-based software for everything. We're open sourcing some of it. We use GitHub. We use Linux software, which it's essentially like a server in space, an open source server in space. So all custom available, or all available software without trying to write our own, trying to leverage as much as we can.
Sounds like I'll be able to control it with my cell phone next week or something in the next build.
Yep.
Ben, you mentioned the control surfaces and basically using electrical current and gyroscopic ideas to reorient the satellite. But can you retask these satellites? A gentleman before me mentioned repurposing them. focusing on let's say, a piece of property that I want to survey, and I want you to optically get down there to do a flight overpass. Can they be used for that, or they are just single purpose, a design for a certain period of time to be up there, and that's it?
So our model is everyone points straight down, which in space lingo is nadir pointing. Nadir is pointing straight down. Though we can point them at other objects. We've taken images of the moon, for example. So we could, with our model, we are a daily image of the whole Earth, and it would take a picture of that property every day. Though if it was compelling enough, we could have multiple satellites take an image of that at higher frequency.
So you could change the image as get it down to a pack of cigarettes or whatever it might be?
No, we cannot zoom with them.
Okay.
They do get higher resolution as they come down and get closer to the atmosphere before burning up, though they never get more than really seeing cars. You can see cars more clearly as they get closer to their end of life, though the resolution is not much better than that.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Can you buy insurance coverage if you're going to use a Russian ICBM to launch? Or is it at your own risk?
Supposedly, you can insure just about anything. Uh-huh. Yes, you can insure
okay, thank you.
Many aspects of launch.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for your presentation. I have kind of a two-part question. One is, what is the ultimate goal of Planet Labs? Is it to image every patch of land, every patch of water 24/7? And kind of related to that question is, what's the bottleneck of scale? You talk about, 11 terabytes of data I think you're taking down right now. Is it really the manufacturing of the satellites? Is it server management? Is it image processing? What's the choke point right now?
So I'll start with the last part. As far as bottlenecks, we really have many bottlenecks. Everything's been developed as needed. So the computers and how fast they can process images in space, the radio link down to Earth has been a bottleneck at times. The amount of power that the solar panels can generate to take enough images has been a bottleneck. And all these we just slowly improve them with each iteration to get to where they need to go. And then also dealing with that large amount of data and serving it on a platform that you can work without latency and see the imagery live. All of it has been building up capabilities at the same time. As far as longer term, we really are pretty focused on this mission. We know there's more we can do, and we're not sure whether there's a value in more frequent imagery than daily. We actually, daily imagery with 150 satellites is kind of a fuzzy number because there are a lot of clouds on the planet, and so that is a challenge for us, is about half our images come down and have clouds, and so having more satellites can pick through the clouds more. There's also we're not currently doing this, but you can do radar from the size satellites. You can do infrared imagery, and those both can see through clouds and see at the nighttime also. And then there's all different spectral bands you can add. So we're doing red, green, and blue color imagery, and then also doing near infrared. And near infrared helps you see crop health. And though you can add more spectral bands in there, more narrow colors. So you could do what's called red edge, which is a little bit towards near infrared from red. And that helps pick out certain aspects of the crops as well. So the more spectral bands you add, the more you could tell, okay, this is underwatered soybeans that are 10 weeks old. And so that added data just gives you more information about everything as well.
Thank you.
Yes, on your launch vehicles, the upcoming launch or whenever it's going to happen for 150 on one launch, was that a move to catch up on the launch delays and some of the losses you've had on the two launch failures, or was it always in the plan that once the company reached a certain maturity, you were going to populate a full constellation with in one launch to have a ubiquitous life, essentially?
It is part of the general launch strategy of still staying diversified and having many launches, though it was a big bet on one launch at a time when we thought we'd be ready to build that number of satellites. So it is kind of an initial get that large population of them up there, and then we'll do more maintenance of them and smaller launches, and then figure out the launch strategy there of how many satellites we need up at a time.
Thanks for a great presentation. I have a two-part question. First, why do you need to send them up to the space station instead of launching them directly from the launch rocket? And part two is, going by your line scanning analogy, if there is, if all the satellites are essentially tracing the same longitudinal orbit, why do you need so many of them? Because they're basically trailing each other. You could do it with one satellite as well, right?
So the reason why we use the International Space Station was probably 10 times the amount of rockets go there as they do to the other orbits. And the space station is set up for cargo to go there, whereas the dedicated rockets that go other places are bought by a many hundreds of millions of dollars large satellite that is probably very risk adverse and does not want a small satellite attached to it, which does not have much financial incentive and is probably not worth the risk. It probably would hurt their insurance more than it is worth it for them to fly ours in small quantities. So that was the approach for us to get initial satellites in space, was to go to the space station. And it still is the most accessible orbit, though it is not ideal for us, and we are moving towards the other orbits. And then the other part of the question was?
Line scanning, if they're in the same longitudinal orbit.
So they all are in the same orbit, in the same plane, though the Earth is rotating under you. So as one comes by after you, it's covering the patch next to it. So there's a delay there as far as when the next one comes behind and follows. If that makes sense.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm coming from maybe a different perspective as a high school student, but I was wondering, when you were in high school, were there any classes or even like clubs that I don't really want to say inspired because it might sound a bit cliche, but kind of kickstarted your interest in this field?
I liked math and physics. I became aware of our changing planet and climate change pretty early on and was pretty connected to that as well. And I think that all came together at some point.
Thank you.
So what would you say are two or three of the biggest innovations or problems that you've solved in the course of putting these small satellites into orbit? And how do you plan on releasing that information, patenting it, licensing it, something along those lines? Are you planning on making those innovations available?
Mm-hmm. I believe one is how we control these and how we've managed to automate as much as we can and make them reliable and then have it so we're actually... We're often doing daily software updates. So our programmers are constantly writing new code, and it gets automatically pushed to space every day. And so that whole approach of making the satellite so even if an intern comes in and writes new code and it goes up on the satellite on their second day of work, it can't totally break the satellite. The satellites can recover from anything and get new software. I think that approach has been brand new to space. Other innovations have been just how compact we've made the electronics, the radios. Our radios were a big innovation. They were and probably hundreds of times faster than anything else that had been built at that size. And then actually the data platform and serving up these images on the web so that they can be accessible has been an innovative approach to this large amount of data.
Hi. From somebody who knows very little about business economics, it's very remarkable that you're able to do this and pay the bills. And so basically, as much as you can summarize it, who does pay the bills and what do they pay it for and why is it worthwhile for them? And just a question about the solar synchronous orbit. What kinds of vehicles are you using primarily to achieve that now?
What sort of rockets are we using to get there?
Whose rockets? And okay. Yeah, because you talked about the problem of certain kinds of rockets are dedicated to very, very high cost satellites, and that they don't want to take on anterior things, etc. So I was curious.
So we are most rockets can go to that orbit. It's just you need to get on one that has spare capacity, or you have to buy the whole rocket. And so we've SpaceX flies to sun synchronous orbits, and they've gone to several. The several Russian ones do. We're on an Indian rocket that'll go there. The Japanese have a rocket that goes there, and the United States has several different other rockets that go there as well. And then Europe has rockets as well. So there's a variety of rockets that go to the different orbits. It's more about finding one that has the spare capacity and a primary payload that is okay to resell some of that extra capacity. As far as our customers and who's funding this, we have been venture capitalist funded, and we're still living off that, though we have signed a large number of customers, customers in consumer mapping, in agriculture, customers that are resellers of the imagery, customers that do market intelligence and actually make gather information on how different industries are performing. There's also infrastructure companies, and then the big ones that we're excited about, which may have less money in them, are the humanitarian cases, and then there's also actually economic use cases that make economic sense in third world countries. So new ways of using the imagery to help large numbers of people in underserved areas as well. And so that's also a innovation we've had, is not just selling imagery to large government contracts who pay large amounts for them, but getting to the point where we can provide imagery at much lower cost for anyone that needs it.
Our thanks to Ben Haldeman from Planet Labs. Give him another round of applause if you like. We'd also like to thank our listening audience here and for those listen to us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is closed. Thank you.